Good morning. The case count of hepatitis A now stands at 168. Everyone is clamoring for the source. State epidemiologist Sarah Park tells us what's clear about this outbreak and what isn't. And we'll hear from Hawaii County mayoral candidate Wally Lau about his platform and whether he can distance himself from the current administration that he once served. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Maui's Emma Farden Sharp Hula Festival honors a legacy and a family tradition. And a lifelong practitioner of craniosacral massage talks about its benefits and how he teaches it to aspiring massage therapists.
It's Thursday, August 11th. That's The Conversation, and it starts after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
There's still a lot we don't know about the hepatitis A outbreak.
Yeah? And that's exactly what's making a lot of people very anxious.
Yeah.
Well, you know, since the first announcement of the hepatitis A outbreak in Hawaii, everyone has been wanting to know how it happened. With cases popping up in different places, largely around Oahu, the Department of Health has discounted a single source and in recent days has said it could be caused by certain common products, though which ones the department isn't yet sure. Yesterday, the case count jumped to 168. I sat down with state epidemiologist Sarah Park to talk about the investigation.
It's extremely challenging given that we're talking about hepatitis A, you know, average incubation period from the time you've potentially been infected to the time you have symptoms is 30 days, you know, 28 to 30 days. The maximum is 50 days. So you're going through people's food histories, asking very open-ended questions to try and gather every little detail, and then having to sort, comb through all that and try to distinguish the weeds from the actual signals. It's very challenging, especially when, you know, a questionnaire to actually administer it from start to finish, an hour and a half. And if you're dealing with someone who's sick, they're not going to sit for an hour and a half. So we have to do multiple calls with them. I would love to have more staff who could deal with looking through the data, sorting through it, and looking at it further to analyze that data. That's where the CDC crew actually comes in.
Right. So how much has that been allowing you to focus in on more of the overall picture?
What they add is just, you know, it means that we can jump a little bit faster on certain things. I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity right now to tell folks and encourage you guys to go to our online website, a survey that we're putting out that's open to the general public. We're actually asking the public for help. What we're looking for through this broad survey is to try and figure out from the responses we get, what are common things? What are establishments that people commonly go to? And what can we expect? What proportion might we expect to see the population say, yes, they go to this place and no, they don't go to this place? And compare that with what we're seeing. Our concern is that we may jump on something and only to find, well, you know, that's actually common in the population. We're asking people one per household. We want it from across Oahu especially, but, you know, we also welcome responses from across the state. It's really to give us a very quick, simple snapshot of our population to hopefully inform what we're looking at from our case questionnaire.
Meanwhile, you have a lot of people who have been told that if they have concerns at all, they should go out and get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Well, kids are covered. I can't tell you how many of my pediatrician friends are so ecstatic to be able to tell their parents that when the parents call and they're worried, to tell them, nope, we vaccinated your child back when they were a baby. Since 2006, it's been part of the regular childhood vaccination schedule. So pretty much all kids under 11 or so have been vaccinated, most likely, if as long as they're up to date on their vaccinations.
Right, but for their parents, for their grandparents,
right,
for people who might have compromised health, that if you're at all concerned.
So, you know, we're encouraging people to consider vaccination. You know, I want to make that clear. And when we're saying consider vaccination, make sure you talk to your healthcare provider. I mean, that's most important, right? To talk to them about your health. They know your health best, right? And to understand what your risks are. What we would say is think about, you know, if you have an underlying liver disease or past history with issues with your liver, whether you have an autoimmune disorder or some other issues with your liver, that would be, you know, a high priority person to potentially get vaccinated, because obviously if you get the infection, your liver is already compromised. You know, this is an infection of your liver. It's attacking your liver. You don't need something more to potentially tip you over the edge. So those folks should really be prioritized.
Does that also include people who are recovered alcoholics?
Right, right, exactly. And anyone else who potentially, where your doctor is concerned, fatty liver, for instance, those kind of things. But also other folks, I would say, right there close with them is anyone with problems with their immune system, other serious medical issues. Because if you're already suffering from one serious medical issue, maybe you're fighting cancer. Maybe, you know, some other chronic illness. You know, you don't need now this liver infection, even though most people are going to resolve. If you're one of those who already have a compromised medical issue, you may be one of those who might be more prone to the severe infection, severe symptoms, potentially an ICU stay or potentially worse. And so those are the folks that really need to be highly prioritized. You know, CDC also puts out on their website who are the priority groups. I'd also reference people to their website in terms of those groups. But the other thing that CDC says is that anyone who wishes to be immune should be vaccinated. But don't forget to wash your hands.
Everyone is really, you know, focused on when you're going to be able to tell people about what you know. Are you willing to share at all anything that might be suspect?
I don't have anything that I can solidly stand on as yet. If I were to say anything right now, it would be extremely premature and it could all fall apart underneath me. And I'd also caution folks, the norm of hepatitis A outbreaks is that most of these outbreaks go unsolved. But you can be assured that as soon as we have something more solid, we would be letting folks know, because our concern is the public's health, our families, our communities. You know, we want to make sure people stay safe.
Dr. Sarah Park, anything else that you think that we should know or talk about?
For those folks who unfortunately have been exposed, or those people we contact directly because maybe they're a friend of a case that they shared food or drink with, I think it's important for them to learn more about hepatitis A, understand what the symptoms are, and monitor themselves for at least the, you know, 50 days. So it's almost 2 months from the time of that exposure point for those symptoms. So fever, tiredness, abdominal cramping or pain, yellowness, of course, of the skin, potentially diarrhea, dark urine, light colored stools. Those kind of things are some of the things that might occur. And if those develop, go see your doctor. You know, don't wait. Go see your doctor so that your doctor can assess you. At the same time, if you do fall ill, take precautions, you know, precautionary measures. We know that this is spread by human fecal contamination, meaning you didn't wash your hands very well and you're sharing food or drink with someone. So if you do fall ill as a precaution, just be extra careful about not contaminating something. If you're in a household with a big family, you know, don't share food or drink with other folks while you're sick. And if you do develop the symptoms that seem like you might have this, or concerning other symptoms, go see your doctor. Call them up.
This is also something that can be a little embarrassing to talk about, too. That may skew who is willing to say what they've done and what they haven't done, because this is, you know, not a nice thing to admit that maybe you didn't wash your hands as well as you should have, or maybe that wasn't it at all because you were contaminated by somebody else.
Right, right. And so I think there should be no embarrassment, shame about this. It's about the public's health. It's about your family's health, your friend's health. You know, if you fall ill, it's important for us to know who you might have been in contact, shared food or drink with. The other thing to realize, too, is that you can be infectious the week or two before you actually have symptoms. So you may not even know, you know, and you're being really careful and things like this, but you may not know. And we've all been rushed. You know, we have to go to a meeting, we have to do something, and you just quickly wash your hands. You think you've washed your hands. So I think we just all have to have this culture of understanding that being really careful about thorough hand washing, it only takes 10 viral particles to cause infection. That's really small.
That's tiny.
It's tiny. So it's not, if you're not absolutely thorough about washing your hands, after you've used the bathroom, before you eat, before you handle any food or prepare any food, serve it, that could be an issue. And so that's just something for people to think about.
Dr. Sarah Park, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Dr. Sarah Park is the chief of the State Department of Health's Disease Outbreak Control Division. A link to the survey that Dr. Park referenced is on our website and Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:14. Coming up, the Maui legacy of Auntie Emma Farden Sharp, celebrated in Lahaina. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Ulana, o Mau, o Kaholabe, o Hawaii.
The Japanese tea house tradition is all but gone in Hawaii. These tranquil sanctuaries of tea and hospitality as an art form have been replaced by tea-themed ballrooms and restaurants. One of the longest surviving traditional tea houses still holds on to its roots and its lease. Opened in 1921, this venue has hosted many notable guests, among them the Super Bowl-winning Pittsburgh Steelers, Island Yokozuna Konishiki, and John Wayne. This Serena Leva Heights Tea House has panoramic views from its second story, and this would be a good time to pay a visit since its name means summer house. So today, we're asking if you can name this place, Hawaii's sole remaining Japanese tea house. Choto Matikarusai will have the answer in a little while. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Phil Moran from Ho'okele Health Technologies. You're tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear from the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
The hula tradition is inseparable from the families that have carried it forward, and halau all over the islands are built on a reverent understanding of the traditions and the people whose legacy they represent. For Ho'olau Moku Ralar, it's a legacy of her great aunt, Emma Farden Sharp, and she and her halau have created a weekend-long festival in her honor. She's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Hi, aloha.
So, how old were you when this became part of your life?
I pretty much danced most of my life. Hula was a very big part of our family and our musical family, the Farden family.
Yeah.
And I became a teacher, though, when I was about 19 to 20 years old.
What was it that made you sort of veer off into becoming a teacher rather than a dancer?
I enjoyed sharing the hula that I had learned throughout my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important thing was that I had a little one, and it was a way for me to be able to stay home with that little one and teach when my husband would get home in the afternoon. So it gave me time to just be home with them, and I would just teach it in the afternoons and evenings.
In terms of what you teach, that really ties into a whole family tradition. As you say, the Farden family is a well-known family
Correct.
In Hawaiian music.
Yes.
Well, how did that legacy become, you know, how did you become aware of that legacy? I imagine it was all around you.
Constantly around me, because my mother was a single child of my grandfather and grandmother. My grandfather was the third, number three child of the Farden family. So I was constantly with those aunties and uncles of that generation, so the real Fardens, and always song and dance throughout my whole life.
When you pass that along, how do you pass along to your students kind of the importance of that the family links?
I would think it's mostly what we pass along is what Auntie Emma passed on to me, was to teach anybody and everybody. It doesn't matter if you are Hawaiian or non-Hawaiian. We want you to just share what we teach so that we can spread to everybody the things that make us happy. You know, being happy when you do the hula is something very important.
That's I like that emphasis, and you don't always hear that in a description of, you know, when you're talking about art and perpetuating art, it's frequently about discipline, which is obviously
right.
Very important. But you're focusing on the spirit here.
Exactly.
Well,
I want to say something about our we have ages. We start at the ages of four, mm-hmm. but our oldest, and I don't even want to say how old she is, but we have older members. We call them our kupuna class. But you know what? You know, they sometimes they can hardly move a little bit. But you know what? They love it so much. That makes me the happiest, when I can share with them something that they want to do and they can share with others in return.
Which, you know, strikes me as one of the really distinctive features of hula, that it lasts throughout your life, that
mm-hmm.
it doesn't depend on that peak period of your life when your body is perfect, as some,
exactly,
some
right.
dance forms do. Go ahead.
Some people do think that, you know, and it's very important to, especially when I talk about the kupuna, but I also talk about the little ones, you know, the little children with the four left feet, I call them. And but then they blossom into, and that's what we call them, our napua, you know, our flowers, but they blossom into something so beautiful. Every dancer that comes to us blossoms.
Which, you know, because I think some people hesitate to get into dance because of that feeling that they're going to put in a few years and then be told they just don't have it. That's been known to happen.
Not in our school, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of great. And was that then, clearly that's very much the way you were taught, as you were saying.
Yes.
What kind of memories do you have of Emma Farden Sharp?
She was my aunt, number one.
Uh-huh.
But with teaching with her, I remember her one time telling me that she said, when you teach, I was a little bit strict at when I first started learning how to teach. And she's like, you got to love. You have to share with them. So I remember her sitting there and she would, and in those days, we used to work with a phonograph. So one of us would be teaching and the other person would be sitting at the table and putting the record on and off.
Uh-huh.
Whereas now we use iPods and everything.
Yeah.
But I remember that was the fondest memory, was for her to be sitting there working the phonograph while I was teaching, and she would smile, and then after class she would say, hey, you know, be a little bit softer on this side and a little bit more forceful on this side.
It's about that balance, isn't it?
It is. Mm-hmm.
Did that take
even a... now with our I have an alakai, someone who teaches with me,
uh-huh.
And she's been teaching with me for 12 years, Kula Lea Kapakungan, and she also does the same thing. You know, I share with her when she teaches what should be and what should not. And that's how we learn.
You know, I couldn't think of a better demonstration of how a legacy gets passed along. And that's in terms of one-to-one contacts generations apart is what you're describing.
Exactly. And you know what is, and it's great in my life. I mean, I don't think my children or even my grandchildren knew that they would be a part of this, but they are. Both of my children dance with me. My husband is a musician. My grandchildren dance. It's, you know, the hula just kind of encompasses who you are, and hopefully my daughter will carry on for me.
I would imagine a great many of your students were not on the path of becoming full-time hula dancers, but just...
Exactly.
What do they tell you about what it's done for their lives, the ones who don't, you know, spend their rest of their lives with it?
You know, to me, I saw in the last maybe 5-6 years, a little bit more of when our studio got a little bit bigger. And I think the people who came because of fellowship. They all, you know, somebody said, hey, I'm taking hula. Why don't you go with us to class? And all of a sudden, more and more students came. It became a hula family for them. So outside of their own families, they have their hula family.
Which says a lot about what it means to so many people in the islands. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're so very welcome.
Have a great festival this weekend. Ho'olamoku Rilar is the organizer of the Emma Farden Sharp Hula Festival, created in honor of her great aunt. It runs Friday through Saturday at the Lahaina Banyan Tree in Lahaina, Maui, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha hi ana Hawaii, naono api hilani e, vavehe ka puaro seilani e, te pua ala ona ona.
The rest of the country is focused on the general election. In Hawaii, it's all about our primary. UH Public Policy Center Director Colin Moore and HPR Contributing Editor Neil Milner take a look at the state's key races, and we want to hear from you. What contests are you keenly watching on your island? Let us know later today at 5 on Town Square.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA Remodel It Right Expo, featuring 3 days of seminars designed to help with home remodeling projects. Tomorrow through Sunday at the Blaisdell, biahawaii.org.
Tulsi Gabbard's rise to national prominence within the Democratic Party and her high public profile may have made a challenge to her seat seem almost unthinkable. Almost being the operative word, especially for Shea-Chan Hodges. With a look at the spirited candidate for Hawaii's 2nd Congressional District, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Now, normally, you know, for races like this, we don't spend, you know, a whole lot of time, even maybe some would say any time, with outlier candidates. So what makes her candidacy, Shea-Chan Hodges' candidacy so special?
Well, we'll see how special it is come primary night. You know, Tulsi Gabbard won landslides her last two races. This is her try for a third term, and you're absolutely right, she is a political superstar. Chan Hodges is a writer on Maui. She's questioning just how progressive Gabbard really is. You might have heard that she's challenged the congresswoman to a debate, which Gabbard has declined to do, saying that's basically hypocritical. Look at how you complain about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and the DNC debates and so forth. She's also raised questions about Gabbard's ties to Sheldon Adelson, a conservative casino magnate, a question about how she spent a lot of her campaign money on TV appearances. India paid for a trip to that country for the congresswoman, who, of course, is a Hindu. She's made a bit of a splash. Meanwhile, Gabbard herself has responded by saying there's dishonest attacks out there. People are twisting my record. And she's been asking a lot of people for a lot more money, even though she's sitting on about $2 million, which is a lot of money for a house race.
Which means that, you know, there's something there certainly has to be a reason that she feels she needs to fire
right
back. Hodges is playing more of the gadfly role in all of this. But the mere fact that there is this dialogue happening, albeit, you know, a difficult one, seems to say that there's more to this story than perhaps we know.
Right. And some have speculated that what Gabbard's truly looking at is a Senate race in 2018 against Mazie Hirono. She denies that she's looking any further beyond her current House seat, but certainly that is out there. And that would be a heck of a race, wouldn't it, Beth Ann?
We'd have a whole lot more to talk about, which we're going to not long from now, perhaps, but who knows? We'll find out. Thanks very much for this morning. We'll talk to you
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Talk to you tomorrow. Everyday Chad Blair joins us with a reality check from Civil Beat. Whoever will be Hawaii County's next mayor may inherit more public scrutiny of the office. With the year-long investigation of current Mayor Billy Kanoi and the trial set for October, the shadow of both may be a difficult hurdle for the next mayor, especially should the mayor be Wally Lau. Up until last January, Wally Lau served as the Hawaii County Managing Director and since then has been talking about his platform, including putting the county's economy first on his list. Wally Lau is considered to be one of the front runners in the mayoral contest, along with former Mayor Harry Kim, although there are 11 other candidates. We spoke with Harry Kim on Tuesday. Wally Lau joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for making the time for us.
My pleasure.
Now, with ethics and trust and transparency of government and elevated focus this election, how do you respond to the concerns that as managing director, you should have known more about Mayor Kanoi's activities?
You know, when people have asked me that, and my comments has been basically, one, the auditor did take a look at my P card and, you know, scrutinizing it, and I came out clean, basically. You know, I followed all the rules, and all my purchases was clean. I had no oversight over the mayor's P card. And when the legislative auditor for the county did, an audit of all the P cards, and made some recommendations of how we can strengthen the P-card procedures for the county of Hawaii. She shared that with me in a memo, and I took a look at it, and I concurred with majority of her recommendations, at which time then as managing director, I turned that over to the finance department, the finance director, who really oversees the P-cards, and told her then to implement these recommendations countywide for all of us to follow. So, you know, in many ways, as managing director, again, following through on the legislative auditor's recommendation.
If you were mayor, would you do anything further?
I think when I looked at the policy, the procedures at that time, it looked, you know, really solid. And I think it's just an emphasizing to all the department heads and everybody that has P-cards that they need to and will adhere to the policies and procedures that is there. And I think we'll be just fine.
You've said that the economy of Hawaii County is your first priority. Aside from, you know, the sectors that you've talked about, including tourism and construction, what's a specific action in any of the sectors that would be first on your to-do list?
I think from the economic standpoint, that's one of my areas. I've always said, you know, to sustain and maintain a healthy economy is very important. And one of the things I think as mayor is really you set the tone for people that want to come and do business on our island here. We have so much beautiful resources that we have to offer. But the mayor has to set that tone to have that kind of broad conversation with people that want to invest in our community.
So what does set the tone mean? What does set the tone mean when you say that?
Set the tone is meaning being able to be a good listener, to be welcoming, to say, hey, come on in, let's talk. What can we do even further regarding renewable energy, for example? And I think the mayor has to set that tone, be a good listener, see and bring the right people to the table to have that conversation along that way. It can be renewable energy. It can be various other type of sciences. It can be tourism. So that person, that leader has to, that's what I call setting the tone, that you are welcome here to have that conversation with the mayor.
You bring up renewable energy, and you've talked about geothermal. In terms of how you would see that go forward on the island when there's been so much conversation and so much conflict over that, what would you see as being the very next step?
Well, I think geothermal is a viable alternative energy here. I've made it very known with, on a condition that one, that the rate bears, that the kilowatt hour rate has to be something that is very meaningful for the rate payers over here. So one is the rate that has to come down to be very meaningful. Secondly, it has to be a place where it's not next to a residence. It can be in a residential area. It has to address all the health and safety issues to assure safety for our people here. And thirdly, it needs to also make sure that it doesn't have a detrimental impact on our environment. So I think with those type of those three concerns that I have, but again, is to bring in these people to the table to talk about it, not only with the industry people, but with the community itself, to make sure that we are all on the same page as far as if we're going to move forward with geothermal. But I look at geothermal as a viable alternative to energy.
Well, Ilau, as you say, you talk about this as a viable alternative energy, and you'd also like to see it be away from where residences are and to be involving with the community. How then would you reconcile that with current conditions?
I think the current one in Pune, they're going through a lot of that right now. I know that when I was managing director, we spent a lot of time and funds to take a look at, and with the community, to look at the health concerns that people were very concerned about, even, you know, with the county itself. So I think it's taking a look at that study and taking a look at it and what are some of the recommendations and moving forward on the recommendations pertaining to the health studies, pertaining to the monitoring of the gases that might be leaking over there. So I think it's happening already, but any future geothermal venture operations, I wouldn't put it next to any kind of residential neighborhood.
We're going to move on just in the interest of time. Hawaii as a state is still grappling with how to feed itself. And you've said that agriculture is the second largest income generator on Hawaii Island and should be supported fully by the county in every conceivable way. What's a specific item in your plan to support agriculture, given the chasm between traditional farming and the anti-GMO movement?
Well, I think, again, for me, in talking to the ag people over here, you know, whether it's the growing of the crops to the cattle industry here, is I think what the county can do is play a more active. We need to take a more active role through our research and development to look at latest researches that and cutting edge researches that are happening throughout the world, and see where we can be more of an advocate for the farmers, whatever they're growing, whether it's cut flowers or cattle or vegetables or whatever. I think we can play a greater role there. I think we need to continue to tag team and play an active role with the State Department of Agriculture, looking at the various type of invasive species that are here and what role can we play even more so. I've also said that some of the prime ag lands that are on our island here, take a look at, can we take a look from a county point of view and zone these for permanent ag lands. Many of the farmers talk to me and they says, you know, Wally, you know, we want to do ag, we have good ag lands, but we don't know 20, 30 years from now if these ag lands will be taken over by development and homes and whatever might be coming in. And my thought has always been is to zone them ag land, that they will stay in ag land into perpetuity, so that these farmers, whatever they're growing, whatever they're raising, know that they can be there, you know, for time, for a long period of time, without having to worry if encroaching development is going to be coming upon them.
Another issue I want to talk to you about is homelessness, and every island is tackling it in a slightly different way. When you talk about how you will counter Hawaii County homelessness, how do you think Housing First fits in, as we've seen Housing First defined by the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
I think Housing First is a viable alternative, and we're, in a sense, using it over here. Right now, at least in Kona, they're doing the micro units, very similar to what's happening on Oahu. And but you don't only have to, you know, for me, it's, you can get the housing, you can have them come in, but the question then is the services. We need to help them help themselves. We're not here to judge why these people are on the streets, but we need to help them help themselves. We cannot enable them. So if you get the housing first and you got them in under a roof over their head, you need to get the wraparound services that are with them, whatever that might be. I know on this island, what we need to do is also, and I've shared this, very active with whatever the state, the federal, private monies, is to get more funding for mental health and drug treatment programs here. Many of our homeless people, and I'm sure it's on Oahu, have severe emotional, psychological, and drug addiction problems. So for me, it's if you can put them under the roof, that's a very good step, first step. But at the same time, we need to provide the service. And the service that I see that is needed is more on the mental health and the drug addiction. So I will put a lot of effort on that end of the spectrum.
We have to leave you in just a moment or two here, but in the Honolulu mayoral race, rail is the lead issue. In Hawaii County, which issue do you see as being comparable to that, something that will be a defining issue for your county, perhaps in ways we haven't even discussed?
Well, for me, and I've said it, you know, certainly not only the economy, but for me, I've always said my top three priorities here is the homeless crisis that we have here. That will define. If we do not get that under somehow manage it, I don't think we'll ever get rid of it, but do a better job managing it and do more, be more aggressive. It will change the quality of life that we know on this island. It will impact the economic outcomes in our communities over here. So for me, homelessness is a very critical thing to take a look at along the way.
What barriers do you see to being able to do what you would like to do to be able to bring in more services, particularly to help those who are mentally ill?
I think that's the whole thing. That's where, in the whole spectrum of the homeless, that's where I would put more emphasis on. And so for me, it's working with the fellow mayors through HCOM, along with the governor and any private individuals or private foundations, to look at how we can work together to address this issue, because it's impacting all of us, all fabric of our life already. And so I would need to, and that's the role again of a mayor, is to take that leadership role. And you're not the expert, but you are the convener. You're setting that tone to say this is so critical that we need to have this very hard dialogue and put together a very aggressive action plan of how we are going to work together as community, not only as an island community, but also as various communities within the island, because it is impacting small towns here on this island already. And so we need to take a look at how is it impacting your community, which then impacts the bigger community.
Wally Lau, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so very much. Aloha.
Wally Lau is running for mayor of Hawaii County. He spent the last 7 years serving as the county managing director and deputy managing director. He resigned from that post in January. Nielsen Research tells us that 1 in 8 of your neighbors listens to Hawaii Public Radio each week. Now, some of them have gone beyond just listening, and with their financial support, have made our service available to the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these good neighbors, Renette Tanaka of Mililani, Connie Wallstrom of Honolulu, and Marva Chun of Kailua. You can do the neighborly thing, too, and become an HPR member donor by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours or by visiting hawaiipublicradio.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Our last program was the tale of two families, the Ogawas and the Nakihes. We left off with young Brent Nakihe behind bars for dealing drugs. Sitting in his cell, he realized he had to change his life. So he did the heavy lifting and made it through rehab successfully. Upon release, he wanted to attend college, but he didn't have the necessary funds. And he was an ex-con, so what scholarship could he possibly get with his record? He applied for and received the Ogawa Scholarship, and this opened the door to academe. Brent thrived in the college environment. Today, he's almost finished with his master's degree in social work and works as a certified substance abuse counselor on Molokai. Although the Ogawas are long deceased, their legacy offered him a chance. Because of their dream and Brent's determination, more people will have a better shot at creating a good life. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
In today's backyard quiz, we visited a hidden gem for aficionados of Japanese fare. Nestled in Aloha Heights, this venue boasts an unparalleled panoramic view from Diamond Head to the airport. Started in 1921, owner Shuuji Fujiwara built a road and installed telephone poles up to the site where he built a small tea house called Shinshoro. It was used as a Red Cross station during World War II, and in 1958, Fujiwara's son expanded and renamed the small tea house, which translates in English as summer house. And earlier, we asked you for the name of this, the last of its kind of Japanese tea houses in Hawaii, the 95-year-old Natsunoya Tea House.
And Beth Ann Leah Alameda of Honolulu had the correct answer to that.
And we'll be getting a T-shirt. And thanks very much to Ryland Suhisa for today's backyard quiz. If you've got one, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Craniosacral therapy is a relatively new practice that has its ardent supporters, but has also drawn a share of skeptics. It's a method of gentle manipulation of the head, neck, and spine that seeks to restore balance in the nervous system. Rich Nelson is a biodynamic craniosacral therapist who teaches its techniques at the Maui School of Therapeutic Massage in Makaua'u. He's a believer, and he's on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
I'm all right, and I'm sure you can give a much better definition than I just did. How would you define it?
Actually, you did quite well to define it in a nutshell. Craniosacral therapy is a form of body work, mm-hmm. and we do use light touch to address the joints and soft tissues of the cranium, the spine, and the sacrum, as well as the soft tissues of the body, with the idea of affecting and regulating the flow of cerebral spinal fluid around the brain and spinal cord, but other fluid flows within the body.
What's the sacrum? Pardon my ignorance.
The sacrum is also known as, it's the bone between our hip bones. It's also the bone where our coccyx is. You heard of the tailbone?
Uh-huh.
The tailbone is the very bottom part of the sacrum. It's a triangular-shaped bone between the hip bones, the ilium bones. And that's part of the craniosacral system. Brain, spinal cord, the vertebral column, and the sacrum.
And so what is it that you do to these parts of the body?
Well, with gentle handholds, the whole idea is to, with very light touch, to address the joints and the soft tissue. In craniosacral therapy, we have a belief that the bones of the cranium, the bones of the skull, actually have a movement. And that movement is vital to the overall functioning of health and well-being of the body. And we believe that improper movement of those bones can affect the overall health of the body. So we believe through this light touch that we can affect movement of those bones via the soft tissues of the body, thus affecting the overall health and well-being of the body.
I thought of the skull as just one big old hunk of bone. There are separations. I mean, obviously the jawline.
There absolutely are. The cranial bone itself is actually made up of several bones, quite a few bones.
That's the top of your head?
Individual bones.
I'm sorry, Rich, on the top of your head, I'm just trying to locate it.
So we have several bones. On the top of your head, uh-huh. We have two bones. If you place your hands over your skull with your fingers meeting in the midline, the two bones there are called the parietal bones.
Huh.
They have a movement very much like the DeLorean car. They flare out. Below those bones, the bones just above your ears are temporal bones.
Mm-hmm.
The bone at the base of your skull is the occipital bone. All of those bones come together to form the entire cranium, as you know it, the skull.
And so you sort of what? Press down, sort of gently move them side
to side? Actually, cranial sacral therapy uses very light touch. It's 5 grams of pressure or less, which is about the weight of a nickel. And with that, we come underneath, basically below the radar of the nervous system. You know, when you make contact with somebody, especially with a firm touch, the nervous system comes online. It says, okay, what's going on?
Uh-huh.
And depending on what's going on with the body may either receive that or resist that information. With particularly sensitive bodies, the light touch of cranial sacral therapy basically kind of comes in underneath the radar of the nervous system. So that's what we're looking at. That's kind of the intention.
Yeah.
And when we come in underneath the nervous system, then we're able to calm the nervous system, regulate the nervous system, specifically the autonomic nervous system that regulates all the automatic functions of the body, heart rate, peristalsis or digestion, circulation, and those kind of things. And when we're able to work on the level of the autonomic nervous system, we're able to work on the level of the full body, address all the systems of the body.
So, Rich, just for example, you could buy through this light touch at key points on the skull, you might be able to, say, slow a heartbeat or reduce stress within the body?
Absolutely. We're able to affect overall autonomic tone of the nervous system. And like I said, the autonomic nervous system is that part of the nervous system which regulates the entire body. So when we're able to work on the level of the nervous system, we are able to bring down stress, regulate blood pressure, and all of those symptoms associated with higher levels of activation in the nervous system.
Rich, I've sort of made a connection in my own mind, and I don't know if it's totally inaccurate or not, but some of the things that you're describing in terms of moving, regulating energy flow within the body remind me of the things I hear from Asian medicine about qi in the body.
You know, there are crossovers in the information, and I like to say, when I teach to my students, that there are no new ideas. We take old concepts and we give them new language. So my belief is that the ancient bodywork modalities of such as Asian bodywork therapy and some of those older modalities and the more recent modalities, and craniosacral therapy has been going on since about the early 1900s. But I believe there is an overlap. We just haven't had enough conversation between the different modalities to see how they fit in together and how they're different.
How did craniosacral...
It's a new language. It's just a different language for those things that we've known for thousands of years, yeah?
Well, Rich, how did, as you say, early 1900s, how did it first come about? Does it have a distinct creator?
It absolutely does. Craniosacral therapy comes from the osteopathic tradition. And in the early 1900s, a student of Dr. Andrew Taylor Stills, who founded osteopathy, Dr. William Garner Sutherland founded the craniosacral concept in the early 1900s. And so that concept has been around for a while, and it's evolved. It evolved from the osteopathic community, where you have the highest degree of practitioners, the highest level of trained practitioners, those who are osteopaths, osteopathic physicians.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the folks who practice this on a very advanced level, all the way down to body workers, massage therapists, physical therapists, chiropractors, and the like.
Rich,
The work has evolved and it's practiced on very high levels, very advanced levels, as well as more intermediate levels.
Who are the people who would be the best candidates for this kind of therapy, could benefit from it the most?
You know, from a perspective of massage and body work, the ideal candidates for cranial sacral therapy are those candidates where traditional touch therapies may not be appropriate for them. So that might be people who are either in acute or chronic pain, long-term pain. It's ideally suited for infants or elderly people or very frail people, those people with communication disabilities who aren't able to accurately relay to you whether they're receiving too much pressure, too little pressure. So that's the population that we really work with, people with chronic long-term pain, chronic pain, autoimmune issues.
Well, Rich, thanks very much for giving us an introduction to this. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I hope I was helpful.
Yes, you were. Rich Nelson is a biodynamic craniosacral therapist and a core faculty member at the Maui School of Therapeutic Massage in Makawao. He teaches introductory classes in the school's massage therapy certification program and a 50-hour biodynamic craniosacral training in its advanced certification programs. Bethann, so much of health education and prevention of things like hepatitis A, as Dr. Park said at the beginning of the program, just come down to really remembering the same very basic things. Wash your hands well. And there's a way to do it well. But, you know, wash your hands the way medical practitioners do. And it's amazing what a difference something that simple can make.
We need to remember those simple things, but also the fact that we are dealing with something that, thankfully, we don't see happen in the United States as they do in third world countries. And so when it happens with us, it comes as a surprise. But you're right, doing a lot of very simple things will certainly minimize whatever might come of this. And we yet really don't know because there are so many unanswered questions.
That's right.
One unanswered question, well, it's not going to be one for long. We're going to be coming back with you tomorrow, and Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation Board Chair Colleen Hanabusa will be here. She'll look at the future of HART, maybe one without her, should she be elected to Congress.
And building hopes and dreams on sand on Kauai.
You can call our talkback line anytime you like and leave your comments in your own voice. Just please remember to leave us your name and the city from which you're calling or town. And here's the number, 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You can hear past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.